justice advocates, staffers, candidates, politicians, just everyday human beings in basically every room that they can, we're not going to hear the new coded language. We're not going to see that new bill. And maybe you are a pro-choice candidate, but if you don't maybe know the new keywords, it's really easy to vote on a bill without knowing the entirety of what got snuck in between the lines. And so training people to recognize other terms, training people just to keep an eye on trends, things like that, there's a sort of awareness that we're training people to have that I think is essential to maintaining Oregon the way it is, because it is very easy to imagine us joining every other state and somehow limiting the access to abortion. And that's terrifying to me. It breaks my heart, frankly. And to make sure that doesn't happen, that means constantly training people. That means asking those people that we've trained to come back and tell us if what they learned actually helped them in the field. We want that feedback, because we want every time that somebody comes in, gets this training, that they can be confident that they have the messaging, that they have the tools, and they have the community to fight this fight that has never gone away and isn't going away anytime soon.
And something that I've learned throughout this podcast, you know, talking to people, going to marches, as a journalist, is that even, and I think we've discussed this, but I would love to discuss it more if you can, is the fact that even in a state like Oregon, there are plenty of folks who have barriers, particularly folks who don't live in Portland or, say, Eugene or Bend, particularly folks who live on the border along Idaho. It's much, much greater distance to go somewhere where there is an abortion clinic. And then Idaho is a trigger law state with far more restrictive laws regarding abortion. Yeah, is there anything that you can speak to about barriers for all folks who need access to abortion within Oregon, and how our neighbor Idaho ever plays a part in that, that you know about?
Of course. Even if a person has, let's say, hypothetically, all the money in the world and all the access, maybe they live here in Portland and there's access to several abortion providers. If you then have to take into consideration economics, lots of low-income folks, how do you miss a day of work to go to your appointment? How do you maybe miss a few more days to recover from the procedure? Can you actually afford to take that time off? Economics are a huge, huge barrier to reaching abortion, even in a state like Oregon. And so that, to us, is important, too, is having advocates and activists who know that even here in Oregon, it can be difficult to, it can be your location, it can be your economic status. There are still barriers. Even here in Oregon, there can still be barriers. And as you mentioned, Oregonians along the border, our folks in more rural Oregon, that can be having to go hours to access a provider, regardless of if you're going into Idaho or if you're here in Oregon. And what do you do if you're in a situation when you can't share this procedure? What happens if we have somebody who's in a situation with an abuser and they can't just hop in the car, go down the street and take care of this procedure? There's, money and distance. Money and distance is always something to factor in when we think about whether abortion actually is accessible, not just legal, but if it's actually accessible. In Oregon, we still have work to do. We need to take better care of our rural Oregonians when it comes to abortion access, and then also just to education about what abortion access is.
I'd like to discuss the fact, and I'm sure, again, you and all the folks a part of this school can talk about this far more than say myself, that over the history of reproductive justice, the reproductive justice movement, it's been very cis female white focused. And, you know, that has certainly changed. But as I've learned, you know, many things actually originated from very strong BIPOC leaders throughout the country, but, you know, like many things, have not gotten recognition or inclusion and so on. Can you talk about how does your school address that in terms of race identity, gender, being more gender inclusive, all the things that don't get a lot of attention surrounding this movement? Yeah, how does your school deal with that?
Thank you for that. It's interesting because we've had as a board, and I know it's happened, of course, with boards in the past, but in this moment in history, but both in our makeup of whom our board is, who we are, that has really changed. You're right. Typically, there's been a lot of cis white women, and grateful for all of our allies, but there are BIPOC people, myself included, who are part of this movement. And yet, our reproductive justice, both as people typically define it and the movement as we know it now, we owe to Black and brown women. And so for the school, it's important for us that when we're picking speakers, when we're building curriculum, even as we were coming together to discuss shared values before a meeting, that we're doing our best to be inclusive in all things and to recognize, basically cite your sources. Mm. Remember who's done the work, honoring these people, trying to stop what erasure we can. And part of that is having diverse people in the room, diverse both race, but then also gender identity, income levels, political positions on a lot of things. We've got a very dynamic, brilliant young board. And every single one of us is dedicated to making sure that, well, frankly, credit goes where credit is due, but also that we're lifting up the voices who are left behind. And for several of us on the board, that's our voice. And that's making sure that we're heard.
For sure. And this is me opining. I don't know if it'll go in through the edit, but something that I personally don't see as a member of the media is enough discussion about what we're talking about, which is rhetoric. You know, this is being called because of the way, obviously, that it originated in the media, is that it's a women's issue. So it's not gender inclusive in the media, in typical mainstream media, that is. And then the focus on who's going to be harmed the most by these bans and already are being harmed, which are BIPOC folks, low-income folks, and then folks who are non-binary, and then folks who might be trans, and then how all of that gets exacerbated if you're in more than one of those categories, let alone just one. So yeah, that's something I appreciate you talking about, and something that I really am trying to get a perspective from folks that I'm talking to. So thank you for sharing your story and your information.
Or even, I mean, like when we changed the campaign school's official name this year, and that was deciding, like, are we Oregon Women's spelled the traditional way, or do we replace that E with an X to make sure that this is open to more than just cisgender assigned female at birth people? And that wasn't just a switch of a letter to be relevant, to be current or anything like that. We spent several weeks going over bylaws, discussing pros and cons, discussing our values, even though we were already at a place where we thought this was a good idea. Like nothing is haphazard in this. Inclusion is both an essential value, but it's something we have to work for. And so another group that we're very dedicated to making sure is heard is the disabled and differently abled community. Mm. How do we reach out to them? How are we training them? And we've had a lot of good feedback about, we did a thing called affinity groups, which is basically making space for for people to be around other people in their identity who might not often get to really bond in this setting. It's like, how, I know when I started campaigns just in 2018, I didn't see a lot of Black and brown staffers. It was a very white world. Wonderful to come to something like this and then spend an hour with other BIPOC folk who are in politics, who can tell me what the world is like. It, that would have been invaluable. I think something I just want to throw out there can be helpful. I think it's important that people know that even if you come to this school and you never work on a campaign, if you never actually go into politics, if this was a good training, you enjoyed it, and that's all you want out of it, that's okay, and that's still important, because of course politics and advocacy and campaigns happen in the spheres we expect them, but you're encountering these situations in your daily lives, in your home. Who are you around? Do you know how to have these conversations? Do you know how to be an advocate in your everyday life? That is also essential to keeping these freedoms, but also to fighting still the taboo in communities, to normalize people having control of their reproductive freedom. I know for me, it's important to reach out to other people in the faith community. I'm a practicing Christian. I couldn't be more pro-abortion if I tried. And for me, that's a matter of my faith coming to bear. And it was wonderful working on a campaign, finding other people of other faiths who also see this as a basic right to your own reproductive destiny. And that doesn't get a lot of attention. Not that it needs credit, sort of thing, but I think people often miss or don't know that there are so many of us who are religious or spiritual people in spaces that are often seen as opponents to reproductive freedom and abortion. And there's allies in those rooms. There's allies in those spaces. And so that's important for me, that other advocates know that, that they're not alone, even in spaces that seem to be the least welcoming to this topic. They're not alone.
That's really interesting. And if you don't mind me asking, just because at this point, while I haven't spoken to a lot of people in general, I have spoken to folks who do identify as Christian and are pro-life. And of course, that's the main message or the main perspective and ideology you see presented in the media, which is that majority of folks who are pro-life are also Christian or some sort of are a member of some sort of conservative religion. And then folks who are more left-leaning and pro-abortion are usually presented as being, you know, atheist, agnostic, you know, not at all religious.
Uh-huh.
Can you talk about what is often assumed to be a conflict of political ideology being pro-abortion and then Christian doctrine or beliefs? Can you talk about what's often assumed as a conflict of beliefs?
Of course. I think it's important for people to remember that a lot of this perceived conflict in belief is in a lot of ways a little more recent. The idea of just left being the abortion team and the right somehow being the defender of the unborn kind of thing, that's not even 30 years ago. It's Republican Ronald Reagan who's signing abortion bills in California, because the perception of this issue changed. It was about your privacy and your family and managing your little unit. This didn't seem to be a big scary thing for the right wing. And then it changed and was politicized. And that's heartbreaking. But when I see how abortion is portrayed in several church spaces, I don't remember a time it hasn't bothered me, because while I understand the proposed intent, what I hear is people going out of their way to do all of the things Jesus told me not to do, which was running around judging people and not loving them and treating them as if they were somehow other. That's not what we were taught or trained to do. So I'm wondering why that's what has become the message. And of course, I know there's a long history of how religious rhetoric evolves and changes around this issue. But for me, it's, as long as I can remember, it's about going back to the basics, which were, my job is to love people the way Christ loved everyone, to do justice, seek mercy, and walk humbly. Nowhere in those values that for me have been a part of my life does it say, tell another person's body whether or not they have to have a child. I don't understand, frankly, how that became a position. I understand logistically, I don't understand emotionally. And it's used and portrayed in a way that preys on people's basic fears, that preys on people's protective instincts. And it's, frankly, I see a lot of messaging and it breaks my heart, A, that it's there, but what makes me even more sad is that there's people that believe it. And if people really go back to the core of what they believe, I think they will see that abortion became a political issue, but this doesn't need to be.
Next, I spoke with Ann Doe, the executive director of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Oregon, a well-known pro-abortion organization that has been working with a coalition of fellow pro-abortion organizations and leaders to call out abortion bans in other states and also strengthen access here in Oregon for vulnerable communities. Here's more with my conversation with Ann Doe. Thank you for speaking with me today. And Ann, just to start out, can you tell me, why are you an advocate in this area of having abortion access and making sure that it stays legal and accessible for all? Can you give me a little rundown of your history?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, it really boils down to the importance of bodily autonomy and how the ability to self-determine and have body sovereignty and determine your own reproductive destiny, especially as people who can get pregnant, is incredibly important when it comes to your own ability to determine your future and make decisions about opportunities or education or supporting your family. And I really saw how this was animated when, through my family. So my parents immigrated from Vietnam after the war, and there's a 12-year age difference between my sister and me.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. She was born in Vietnam, immigrated to the United States when she was six, and then there's like another six-year gap before my parents even considered having another child. And I know how much the sort of economic stability of my family, and not just my family, my immediate family of my parents and my sister, but all of the family that they sponsored from Vietnam to come to the United States to start a new life, all of that was contingent on my parents being able to space their children and determine when they wanted to have another child, when they were able to have another child because things were stable enough and economically they could afford to. And like the folks that they had brought to this country were on their feet and able to be in jobs and able to get housing. And so I really know how intimately tied to like one's ability to provide for one's family, to be able to make a better life for oneself, having the ability to family plan, to have access to contraception, to choose when and whether to become a parent, including whether or not to terminate a pregnancy, is not just for one's own life, but for your family, for your community. And so that's a really bedrock reason, and like one rooted in sort of my own family's ability to, you know, establish a new life in a new country, And a huge reason why I do this work.
And something I just want to point out, and something you're talking about, you know, something that's very specific to those who are immigrants, but also anyone, but obviously especially immigrants, where when the topic of, you know, the point of view that an abortion is a moral issue for those, particularly those who are pro-life, it sounds based on, from your point of view, that's a luxury to think that way, that not everyone has the financial means to raise a child, to have that as an option, whether or not they want to. And like you were mentioning, for your family, you know, they needed to wait, like many families, until they are financially stable and able to raise another child.
Yeah, I think that, you know, for me, abortion is healthcare. Mm-hmm. And abortion is a private medical decision to be made by the conscience and the sort of governed by the moral agency and authority of a person, of an individual. And I think that it really is not up to anybody else to weigh in on somebody's medical decisions or what they do with their body. And I think that every person has the moral agency to be able to determine what is best for them. And what's best for them based on sort of what you outlined, the whole matrix of decisions, which also includes whether or not they are in a position to be able to have a child, or even if they want to be able to be a parent in that moment. And so I think for me, I think it's really a critical core issue of acknowledging not just that abortion is healthcare and a private medical decision, but also a right, a civil liberty that has existed and been affirmed in the United States for 50 years. And I think that, you know, as we're sort of having this conversation, obviously because of the context of the Supreme Court hearing a Mississippi 15-week abortion ban and the news coming out of Texas with Senate Bill 8, I think it's really important that as we're talking about this, we also focus on the fact that what is being considered in the Supreme Court right now is actually having the court rescind rights and civil liberties afforded to individuals in this country, right? They're allowing, they could, in the decision that they issue for the Mississippi case, be opening the door for states to take away fundamental rights that have existed for individuals in this country. And I think that's a really critical piece of the conversation as we're talking about access to abortion care and reproductive rights.
For sure. And in all my conversations with folks, particularly those in the reproductive justice movement, is that this, and you would know more than this, of course, is that this didn't happen overnight. It didn't happen just over the course through the pandemic. This has been a gradual and very intentional, I guess you could say, campaign among those who are pro-life and those who are who have the legislative power to make these laws. Like we're seeing, like you said, in states like Mississippi and Texas. And then there's this ripple effect. And for those who are following the news, as many are, there are states that are trying to copycat the very historically, I guess you could say, profound and confusing law in Texas. Like states like Oklahoma are trying to copycat in Texas. And then something that I've heard in interviews with the National Abortion Federation, they are trying to assist those in Texas to get abortions out of state, and for many the closest state is Oklahoma. So the main reason I'm talking to people is showing that these states don't live on islands. Every other state impacts each other, and that's happening now and has been with Oregon and Idaho. And I'm curious if you could speak to what sort of barriers exist for Oregonians that folks living throughout Oregon may not know. And how is our relationship, our geographical relationship, impacted by being close to a trigger law state like Idaho?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think goes to the heart, both in Oregon and just nationally, that for many, the right to an abortion was a right only in name, because many individuals were unable to be able to access the care they need when they need it, based on geography, based on insurance coverage and the ability to afford that care. And that's something that even here in Oregon, where we have the right to an abortion codified in state law is something that people still grapple with. So the Hyde Amendment is an amendment, a budget rider that is attached to different budgets that are get passed by the federal government. And what it essentially does is it prohibits any federal funds to go towards abortion care, which means that, you know, folks who rely on Indian health services, like our Native folks, aren't able to get their abortion care covered. Folks who are veterans or active service members, same deal, or people who are, you know, federal employees. And there are certainly many of those individuals who live in our state. And so coverage for, you know, abortion care and that essential piece of healthcare is one that is not complete here in our state. And so there are plenty of folks who still can't afford to get the care that they need. Access via geography, like just living too far away from a provider, is also another big barrier. So when you're talking about the impact here in Oregon, being a neighbor to a state like Idaho that has a trigger ban, which basically means that if the Supreme Court was to undermine Roe versus Wade or gut it in its ruling in this Mississippi case, that there are existing laws and statute in Idaho that would kick into effect without that protection of Roe and effectively ban abortion in the state. And many folks who live in Eastern Oregon actually rely on Idaho going to Meridian or to Boise in order to get the care that they need, because that is actually closer to them than driving, you know, to Bend, which is where one of our health centers is and where abortion care is available. And so we know that this is going to have a huge impact on those folks living in Eastern Oregon, and also in the folks who live in Idaho, right? Because they also will have to rely on traveling to Oregon or to Washington to get the care that they need. Oregon could see a 234% increase in out-of-state patients, according to some recent studies evaluating the impact of Roe being decimated. And in another analysis, we see that Eastern Oregonians could experience up to a 35% decrease and access because of longer travel needed to get to the nearest provider. And we know no one should be forced to drive hundreds of miles to get the care that they need. And I think one of the biggest barriers too is not just driving hundreds of miles, it's also needing to take time off of work. It's also needing to get your expenses covered when it comes to travel or childcare, and in addition to being able to cover the procedure itself. And so all of those barriers really stack up upon each other, and we'll just get all that more worse in a landscape where states are allowed to ban abortion.
You mentioned something about the Hyde Amendment and obviously federal funds not being able to be used to fund abortions. So can you clarify for that for me and then for the audience, of course, does that include then Medicare, Oregon Medicaid and Oregon Medicare care, that it can't be used to provide abortions?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So Oregon does cover abortion care for its Medicaid, Medicare population, but it does so by utilizing state funds. So they don't use any federal monies to cover abortion care for the Oregon Health Plan enrollees. They exclusively use state funds to be able to do that. And they're one of 17 states that actually provides abortion care for Medicaid populations. And that was a conscious choice, and one that actually has existed in our state for decades, and most recently was affirmed in 2018. I don't know if you recall, but in 2018, ballot measure 106 was a backdoor ban on abortion that sought to take abortion coverage and care away from folks who rely on the Oregon Health Plan. And voters overwhelmingly defeated that ballot measure and voted no, and really affirmed that here in Oregon, the majority of folks really support people's ability to access abortion care when they need to, regardless of how they're insured.
Are there any consequences to being complacent or apathetic about this issue? Having such a progressive state, progressive abortion laws in a state like Oregon, is that something we can expect to see, regardless of what happens to Roe, that abortion rights are cemented into state law?
I think that's a great question. So the thing that I like to say is that Oregon didn't get here overnight, right? It wasn't that we magically woke up and we were one of the most pro-sexual reproductive health care, expanding access to abortion, protecting it in our state law. We did not codify the right to abortion in our state until 2017. So I think that's always interesting. We were one of the first states to not make it illegal before the Roe decision, but we did not codify that right in state law until 2017 with the passage of the Reproductive Health Equity Act and with champions like Speaker Kotek and Governor Brown and, you know, all sorts of, and all are like champions in the Senate and the House. But we worked really hard to be able to elect those pro-sexual and reproductive health care champions. One of the biggest lessons I think we all need to learn is that state elections matter a lot. And with a court that comprised with the individuals that it has now, with those being lifetime appointments, with a number of those justices being very young, it's going to matter more than ever that we're working hard and not being complacent to make sure that we're voting up and down the ballot for people who are going to protect our fundamental rights and freedoms and expand access to health care. Because in the last 4 or 5 years has taught us anything, it is not to take anything for granted and not to feel like you are just safe in your little like corner of the world, because no man is an island. And we should care about what's happening in Texas, and we should care about what's happening in Mississippi, and we should be thinking about how Oregon can be a leader and a beacon for folks who need to get care and might need to travel to our state to do so. Roe has always been the floor, not the ceiling. We know that it has not been enough.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 10 a.m. Next up is American Standoff with Jacqueline Keeler.